This is special programming from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. It's been 11 weeks since the campfire started. Tonight on After Paradise, we bring you the latest from last night's Paradise Town Council meeting, and we look to next week, next Thursday to be precise, January 31st, a day of some very big deadlines, including signing up for FEMA and the state's debris removal program for those who have been displaced by the campfire. It's also the day the final remaining Red Cross shelter is set to close. Hundreds still remain there. We'll speak to those being housed there about where, if anywhere, they can go. And we still want to hear from you. Leave your questions about campfire recovery on our website, mynspr.org. And stay tuned because we'll be answering many of your questions this evening. For Thursday, January 24th, 2019, this is After Paradise. Last night at a council meeting, Paradise officials took several steps aimed at getting the town and its residents back on their collective feet. But they delayed discussion of controversial rules that strictly limited temporary use of RVs and trailers. North State Public Radio's Mark Albert was there and sent this report.
Town officials quickly approved measures asking state taxpayers to replace lost property tax revenue, waived some business license fees, and agreed to hire a lobbying firm, but other issues may take longer. Paradise Irrigation District's water remains unsafe to drink. That's according to spokeswoman Mickey Rich. She said extensive testing will soon take place. The utility plans to prioritize finding and removing contaminants from lines along Skyway. She said workers are still restoring service to homes left standing. Repairs have been slow due to extensive damage. Debris removal is another major headache. With the deadline to sign up a week away, fewer than half of property owners have signed up for the state's debris removal program. That's according to Eric Lamoureux, a spokesman for the Governor's Office of Emergency Services. Paradise resident Tom Kelly said the deadline should be extended.
The disaster is the largest in the history of the United States since 1918, so somebody's going to have to cut some slack here.
Those declining the service must have the same work done to the same standard. Either way, some cleanup costs are covered by insurance. Costs beyond policy limits are picked up by taxpayers under the state program. Under the alternative program, property owners are stuck with whatever insurance doesn't cover. Some have been reluctant to sign the required right-of-entry forms, which protect debris removal contractors from litigation. Those declining both will have bigger problems. Debris removal will happen anyway, likely by the same contractors, with officials billing property owners through tax liens. On the thorny issue of parcel sizes and living in an RV or trailer during reconstruction, the council punted. Mayor Jody Jones said she was warned by FEMA that an ordinance could jeopardize aid and postpone discussion to an unspecified future date. Mark Albert, North State Public Radio News.
Looking at other important deadlines, January 31st is also the last day to sign up for disaster assistance from the Federal Emergency Management Agency and the U.S. Small Business Administration. You can sign up at the Disaster Recovery Center in Chico or in Oroville. For more information, you can go online to buttecountyrecovers.org. Now we're going to take a bigger look into debris removal. Again, according to Eric Lamoureux of the Governor's Office of Emergency Services, fewer than half of the property owners affected by the campfire have signed up for the state's debris removal program, and the deadline to do so is in a week. Those who do not sign up for the state's program will have until February 28th to register for the alternative fire debris removal program. That entails finding a licensed contractor and submitting a work plan to the county. NSPR's Mark Albert spoke with Butte County spokesperson Casey Hatcher to learn more about the debris removal requirements for those who lost structures and homes and about the differences in the two options.
Anybody who had a structure burn in the campfire that was 120 square feet or more is, whether that was your home or other structure, is required to clean up the debris on their property. And they have to do that by either signing up for the government program and submitting a right of entry form or hiring a qualified contractor and signing up for the alternative program. The deadline to sign up for the government program, which can be done for no out-of-pocket cost to the property owner, is January 31st.
And if they don't sign up for it, they have to sign up for the alternative program. The alternative program, likely using the exact same contractors or contractors with the same licensing And therefore, they have to pay fees to the state of California for the, to renew their licenses. And it's more than just getting, you know, Bob from down the street to make a dump run.
The alternative program requirements match exactly the same requirements that CalRecycle will use to clean properties under the state program, which we're calling the government program. So they mirror it exactly. You have to do the same treatment to make sure there's air monitoring, to make sure you test for asbestos and remaining hazardous materials, to make sure that the soil is tested. At the end of the day, there's going to be a certificate provided by Environmental Health that says this property's free of contaminants and it's clean to rebuild. And we want to make sure, whether you do the government program or hire a qualified contractor and do the alternative program, that that property is ready to rebuild and it's clean for the community.
The reason why the government program costs nothing out of pocket is because the government's working with the insurance industry or with the insurers, and whatever your insurance doesn't cover for debris removal, the government backfills that, so there's no out-of-pocket expense. If you do have any kind of deductible for debris removal, that's covered. If the cost exceeds the benefit on your insurance for debris removal, that's covered. If you want to proceed, if you don't trust the government for some reason, refuse to sign a right of entry form, which I think is what is the concern, it's the same deal, except that the government's not going to backfill it.
So the government program is fully funded by taxpayer dollars, federal, state, and local level. And they can't duplicate benefits. So if you have an insurance benefit for debris removal specifically, or it's part of your overall policy if you rebuild or rebuy, then the county will collect that portion of your insurance so that we don't duplicate a benefit that you have from your insurance with taxpayer dollars. That's how it works. But if you don't have enough for what the full cost of debris removal will be, that's okay. That will be covered by the government program. So you are really only required to reimburse the county for the amount that's in your insurance that's for debris removal.
And if you refuse to sign up for it, then what happens? What's the potential here? What's the problem? And why do you, as a government entity, why do you care?
Well, if you don't sign up for the government program, which is the right of entry form, then you will be required to use the alternative program. Hire your own contractor. They have to be properly licensed and the consultants have to be properly certified. If you don't do either one of those, we have a health emergency here. So these properties are contaminated. There's contaminated ash and debris on these parcels, and it has to be cleaned up. So the town and the county will likely use their code enforcement and a nuisance abatement process to go through and make sure the cleanup is done. The problem with that is that property owners will end up bearing the full cost or having their properties liened.
So if you don't sign up for the government program and you're insurance for debris removal does not cover the full cost of the debris removal with all the licensing, all the inspections, and everything else. You personally have to pay out of your own pocket the difference.
That's right. So,
and that could be, I mean, I know that every insurance policy is different, every debris removal job is different, but do you have any kind of ballpark idea?
Well, we know that the state has been saying that the debris removal costs for them on average in other fires has been anywhere between $80,000 and $100,000. And most people have a portion of their policy that's like 5%. So they're ending up with anywhere from $15,000 to maybe $35,000 for debris removal. So that's the portion that they would owe back to the county in the event that they signed the right of entry and entered the government program. They don't pay the remainder, right, because it's funded by the government. So if you hire a private contractor, and I don't know what those bids are coming in and looking like, you're fully responsible for paying that bill to your contractor, regardless of what you have in your insurance for debris removal.
At a town council meeting last week, and I'm not sure if you were there, or 2 weeks ago, somebody came up and said that the state or the town does not have the power to prevent a homeowner from cleaning their own debris, regardless of licensure, or permits or anything.
Well, the California Constitution gives local jurisdictions the ability to pass urgency ordinances. Both the town and the county have passed urgency ordinances related to fire debris removal and indicated the environmental and public health issue that we have before us because of the tremendous number of properties that have burned structures on them. And the requirements are set such that these properties get cleaned up and don't continue to create a public health situation in our communities. And so the local jurisdictions can require that a properly licensed contractor clean up this debris, because this isn't cleaning up some junk that you have on your property. This is contaminated fire debris and ash. It needs to be properly handled. It needs to be properly hauled through the community so that it doesn't create airborne asbestos in the community as it travels. So there are special handling requirements for this type of fire debris and ash, and the magnitude of how many burned structures there are is what creates that public health hazard.
So a homeowner is not allowed to clean up their own property.
A homeowner is not allowed to clean the fire debris from their own property unless, of course, they happen to be a properly licensed contractor, which, of course, we have some of that. But by and large, a property owner is not allowed. They either need to sign up in the government program or they need to sign up and for the alternative program and submit a work plan to Environmental Health, which gets approved before they can begin the work.
That was Butte County spokesperson Casey Hatcher. If you still need to register for either debris removal program, we have all of the information you need at our website, mynspr.org. There's also a drop-in session for debris removal resources happening Saturday in Paradise. It will take place at the Terry Ash Recreation Area that's located at 6626 Skyway from 10 in the morning until noon. Those who were displaced by the campfire have flooded an already tight rental market in Butte County. Authorities say every single unit that is available has been occupied, and renters are now essentially playing a game of housing musical chairs. Now add to the list of concerns Chico residents getting evicted so their landlords can move in family members affected by the fire. KQED's Sonia Hudson reports.
Hi, come on in.
April Whitley has lived in this Chico home for the last 3 years, but she won't for much longer. Whitley says her landlord called at the end of November to tell her she needed to move out because she wanted her daughter, who lost her home in the fire, to live there.
There's been a lot of emotions. It's been really tough. My initial reaction was, oh my gosh, I have nowhere to go. There's nowhere in Chico.
Whitley tried buying a house, and she thinks because she doesn't have extra cash on hand, the post-fire market is even harder for her to navigate.
We went to the bank, got pre-qualified for a loan, and in looking, it's just we don't have the cash that folks from Paradise have with their insurance money, so we can't compete in the bidding wars that are happening right now.
And they haven't been able to find a home they can afford in Chico or the surrounding areas. So she's moving her family to her brother's place in Capay. Her kids will live in his extra bedrooms while she and her husband stay in a trailer on his property. Whitley's landlord did not respond to a request for comment. Now, owner move-in evictions are perfectly legal, and while Whitley wishes she had more security in her lease, Chico Mayor Randall Stone says this is just another hurdle the city has to deal with after the fire.
What we can do, we've done from a legal standpoint, and what we can't, we can just provide resources to make it easier and better, trying to preserve the tax base and the employment base as much as humanly possible.
To deal with that problem, Stone says he's working to incentivize development through permit fee reductions and inclusionary zoning. For North State Public Radio, I'm Sonia Hudson.
You're listening to After Paradise, a special production from North State Public Radio. More just ahead. This is After Paradise, a special program on the aftermath of the Camp Fire from North State Public Radio. I'm Sarah Bohannon. Housing insecurity and looming evictions are not only an issue for those renting an apartment or house in Chico. As North State Public Radio's Mark Albert explains, in 1 week, those weathering the fire's aftermath in Spartan conditions and shelters are about to lose that too.
A week from today, the last remaining evacuation shelter will close up shop. Operated by the American Red Cross under contract as of Tuesday, 170 people were housed inside. With pets banned, a perhaps equal number of people were roughing it in tents, vehicles, and trailers outside. Red Cross officials said they did not know exactly how many and declined to provide an estimate. Red Cross spokesman Stephen Walsh said the organization's main role is short-term, immediate response.
We are not in the business of, you know, long-term sheltering, you know, beyond what we're doing now. And so that's where partners like the county come in and the city to help us help these people find options.
County caseworkers and other officials are trying to find other accommodations. Again, Stephen Walsh of the Red Cross.
This is a very challenging time. I mean, people need to make some, you know, serious adult decisions on, you know, what's going to happen in their future. And we in the county and all the other partners are doing our best to tell them what the options are.
Officials say they've made great progress, but it seems doubtful they'll find places for everyone. Pressed, county officials say it's their goal, hardly an ironclad promise. Among evacuees, the looming deadline is another challenge for those who've lost everything. Calvin Christian says he's turned down offers because they were too far afield and too expensive.
I'm not sure that I could have afforded leasing a motorhome at this time, and I'm trying to stay close to Paradise, as I've said. Some of the places are like Yuba City, maybe Corning and or Durham. I'm running back and forth.
Trudy Kennedy said she hasn't seen a huge effort on her behalf, but she has options.
They're not moving mountains for me, but if I can't find something by the time of closing, then I can use the FEMA money that I have to stay in FEMA hotels.
Jack Felione found an apartment on his own, striking pay dirt online and inking a deal on a rental listing that was live for just over an hour.
I did find an apartment here in Chico, so I'll be moving in my first apartment ever. I've always lived in a home or, you know, SFD, single family dwellings, but we just signed a 1-year lease. So I'll be moving out when they close the facility here.
Brad Elliott said his pit bull hasn't exactly opened doors. He's not sure where he'll go.
8-9 days from now, I'll have everything I belong in one backpack. I'll have my pit bull and most of my weight will be dog food. And I'm going wherever Red Cross is going. Or I'm going to go right over here to that PG&E camp around the corner. I'm going to throw my tent right up in that little area right there because they burnt my fucking house. They burnt my nephews, my sister-in-law. Nobody in my family has a house. Nobody in my family owns a home. Everybody in my family's homeless, if you want to regard it like that way. But I'll go right over to the PG&E camp. I mean, why not? All those cats are from out of state making big money, and here we are.
Robert Storbeck has relatives in Southern California, but the 71-year-old who was using a wheelchair Tuesday said there's no room for him there, and there's no way he could afford anything down south. He's reluctant to accept housing requiring a long drive back up to the ridge.
I don't know for sure yet. I'm hoping I get a FEMA trailer, but maybe that'll happen or maybe it won't.
Both the Red Cross and county officials say there are no plans to extend shelter operations beyond the 31st.
We've finally had time to dedicate a space on this program to answer your questions. You've submitted a ton of questions online, and many were about debris removal, so we will start with those. Here we go with question number one. This was submitted by Carol, who wants to know, what if a neighbor does not sign a right of entry or hire a contractor to clean their lot debris? If you have a neighbor who had a structure or a home that burned on their property and you think that they've left the area or you don't think they're intending to sign up for debris removal, then the county is actually asking that you reach out to that neighbor.
We have over 13,000 property owners here. And us being able to reach all of them is difficult, right? And so we're asking the community, if you know where neighbors have gone and you can reach out to them and let them know that there's this opportunity to sign up for the government program with no out-of-pocket costs to do that, we will eventually be coming through with some sort of a code enforcement process to make sure that all of the properties get cleaned up.
Again, that's Casey Hatcher with Butte County. She's going to be helping us with all of these debris removal questions. The next question was submitted by Sandra. They want to know, will Zone 7 be the last debris removal scheduled like it has been for reentry and for Phase 1 cleanup? The answer to this is probably not. Hatcher says while Phase 1 cleanup does have to be finished before Phase 2 cleanup can start, Phase 1 is about 80% complete and a few months ahead of schedule, so CalRecycle and CalOES are just starting to figure out where they're going to go for Phase 2.
They are putting together a plan for what that looks like based on where they have a lot of right of entry forms. So where they have a lot of people signed up and it's really efficient to go and mobilize to that area and clean up, that's where they'll go.
She says they're also looking at things like protection of watersheds, public sites, and school sites.
They have three prime contractors that CalRecycle is going to hire, two to work in the town and one to work in the unincorporated area. So they are going to have people working throughout the entire area, but they're still really planning up exactly what that operation is going to look like and where they're going to start and how they're going to move.
Our next question is from Jewel. They said there should be an extension to opt into the government debris removal program. They want to know what will make that happen.
We have heard this question from a number of people that they feel like they haven't had enough time to make a decision and they'd like the deadline to be extended. Right now, it's January 31st. So what we encourage everyone to do is make sure that you can get the information you need to make a decision. So we have several meetings coming up. You can go to buttecountyrecovers.org. You can go to the Disaster Recovery Center in Chico or the ROE Center in Oroville to ask your questions and get information. You do not want that deadline to pass without signing up.
And Dave wants to know, why does the state require the landowner to sign a hold harmless agreement that prevents any recourse if damage occurs during state cleanup?
It's also probably a good question for CalOES and CalRecycle to speak to the hold harmless clause, is what people are calling the hold harmless clause in the right of entry form. What they have said is that there could be some incidental damage that happens, and it's difficult to do an operation like this, right? The potential for damage certainly does exist, and which is why that clause is in there. If it's egregious, they have indicated that there will be a mechanism for going and looking at those. They have done that in previous fires and fixed property damage. What we can say is that the best way to make sure that your property doesn't get damaged is to make it very clear on your right of entry form what is there to damage. So mark out your septic tank or any other subterranean utilities so they know where the water comes in, where the propane comes in, they know where your leach field is. Make sure they understand if there are things that you want to keep and retain on the property. So you can include all of that. When they call you 24 to 48 hours before they're going to clean your property, tell them that you want to walk the site with them. Show them where the things are that you don't want to have damaged. Tell them if you plan to keep your driveway. Have that conversation with them. They'll do that for you.
And moving to a question from Kevin. Kevin asks, PG&E fell large trees on my property outside of the public utility easement. Who is responsible for removal of the trees?
We are suggesting that property owners contact PG&E. They actually have a number on their website if there are trees that were fallen and you want to have them removed.
Looking at non-debris removal questions from you. In other questions, Brenda asked, how many people are still unaccounted for in the campfire? According to Miranda Bowersox, the media liaison at the Butte County Sheriff's Office, there are still three people missing. They are John Demianu, Wendy Carroll, also known as Wendy Krug, and Sarah Martinez Fabula. Another question from John was, where can I submit keys for the Phoenix sculpture? First, a little backstory. The Phoenix sculpture is called the Key Tribute Project. It's being created by Paradise resident Jessie Mercer, who lost her art studio in the fire.
One of the things that struck me the day of was so many people left and were scattered and just didn't know if they were going home that day. But one thing that was so uniting is that everyone left with their keys. And so when I realized that we all had these keys that no longer had doors to open, I felt kind of a profound need to somehow bring us back together.
Mercer is collecting keys from those who lost homes. She'll use the keys to create a phoenix sculpture for the city hall and is collecting these keys until February 1st. There are several drop-off locations. Those include Blackbird Books Gallery and Cafe on Park Avenue, the Museum of Northern California Art on the Esplanade, and the Rustic Nest on Main Street. All of these are in Chico, and you can find a full list of drop-off locations at our website, mynspr.org. You can also contact Mercer directly by emailing her at jessiemercer15@gmail.com. Again, that's jessiemercer15@gmail.com. And lastly, Jean was wondering if we'd announce an invitation for campfire survivors to submit their writing to a literary journal that's being published. It's called Remembrance. The journal will be a collection of works by survivors, including poems, stories, and journal writings. As long as the writing is shorter than 4 pages, then you can submit it. Those who are interested can email submissions to Jean at verdathescribe@gmail.com. Again, that is verdathescribe@gmail.com. And that's our program for Thursday, January 24th, 2019. We're produced by Mark Albert, Phil Wilkie, and Tess Vigeland. Adam Raguzia composed our theme music. Our engineer is Matt Fidler. Special thanks to KQED and Capital Public Radio. And don't forget, we want to hear your questions. Ask anything you want to know about post-campfire recovery at mynspr.org. Thanks for being with us. I'm Sarah Bohannon, and this is After Paradise from North State Public Radio.